This is Going Up Alleys, Episode 7, James and the Little Neutral One. Back to another episode of Going Up Alleys. I'm your host, Stephen Sekula. On today's episode of Going Up Alleys, we're going to talk to Professor James Loach about the neutrino. But before we get to the actual interview with Professor Loach, let's take a few moments to talk about the history of this elusive subatomic particle. Now, the word neutrino is actually Italian for the little neutral one or small neutral one. And it's actually a word that was coined in 1933 by a physicist named Enrico Fermi. He coined it because he had to resolve some linguistic confusion. And in order to understand that confusion, we have to talk a little bit about the slightly deeper history of the neutrino. So the idea of this particle, the neutrino, was postulated in 1930 by a physicist named Wolfgang Pauli. And he did this in order to explain what appeared to be energy that was entirely missing from the reaction products of certain nuclear decays. And the nuclear process involved is known as beta decay. Now, Pauli postulated that an as yet unseen, new, nearly massless, and zero electric charge particle was carrying away this energy, and all one had to do was see it. But how do you see an extremely hard to see tiny subatomic particle that has so far eluded detection? So at the time, he dubbed this particle the neutron. But there was a problem with that, because just a year later, in 1931, another physicist named James Chadwick discovered a new, heavy, electrically neutral particle in the nucleus, and he dubbed it the neutron. Now, this thing, the neutron, discovered by Chadwick, this is the partner of the proton that we know today. The proton and the neutron are found in every atomic nucleus except that of hydrogen. So the neutron plays an extremely important role in the structure of atoms and of nature. So that's the partner of the proton that we know and love today. So Fermi decided to resolve this problem, this elusive particle that still hadn't been detected, and this new heavy particle present in every nucleus that was detected by Chadwick. These were not the same particle. So Fermi coined the word neutrino, small neutral one in Italian, to label Pauli's idea of a nearly massless or entirely massless new particle that's carrying away energy during nuclear beta decay. Now, Pauli's idea was not entirely taken seriously. This sounds crazy, right? A new particle, impossible to detect, with zero mass and no electric charge? What beast is this? So this seemed ludicrous to a lot of folks in the physics community. And as often happens, when you don't have data, but you have competing ideas about what the answer should be, you have competing hypotheses. So in contrast to Pauli's idea of inventing a new subatomic particle, physicist Niels Bohr suggested that maybe energy conservation laws were the problem. Maybe energy isn't conserved in every reaction. Now, that energy was conserved in every reaction had been an assumption based on prior observational evidence, experiments with energy, for instance, in chemical reactions, and there it always seemed to be conserved. So Bohr reformulated the laws of energy conservation into a new, more flexible framework that would allow for such violations of energy conservation to be observed in things like nuclear decays, which hadn't even been known to exist until the early 1900s. So the question is, who was right? And as is always the case in science, you have two hypotheses, they can make predictions, now you can go and conduct experiments to look for the consequences of those two sets of predictions. So we basically have two alleys, and in fact one of them or both of them could be blind alleys. Neither of these answers might be correct. It took a long time to answer this, but in 1956, two physicists, Clyde Cowan and Frederick Rhinus, demonstrated the reality of the neutrino as a particle by capturing neutrinos. And they did this by using a nuclear reactor as a source of neutrinos. If the neutrino is really a particle produced in nuclear reactions, reactors should be making them. And then they used the reverse of the beta decay process to capture those neutrinos. So if it really is a particle and it really results from beta decay, you can actually run the reaction backward by having a neutrino smack into the nucleus of an atom, and you can look for the consequences of that. That's the prediction of the neutrino hypothesis. And they actually saw it in 1956. So from Wolfgang Pauli's proposal in 1930 until the discovery of the neutrino itself as a particle took 26 years. So you should ask yourself, why does this basic piece of information matter at all? The discovery of the neutrino was itself, in fact, transformative to our understanding of the universe. We understand now much better at a deep level the very engine that powers our star, our sun, thanks to the neutrino. And we understand nuclear physics that has revolutionized medicine here on Earth for human beings. So it's the neutrino, and the fact that we really understand at a deep level nuclear reactions has revolutionized our understanding of treating things like cancer within the human population. So from such a seemingly simple and basic question, why does energy appear to be lost in the beta decay of atomic nuclei? You have a transformative answer, the existence of the neutrino, that altered our world. And this is why it's important to support science, to encourage kids when they ask basic questions about the world, and for you to seek out the answers to questions that you think maybe at first might seem trivial or silly. No such thing. You never know when you're going up an alley to see if it's blind, if it will turn into some world-changing experience. So I'm joined today on the program by SMU undergraduate Nicole Hartman, who came to SMU in 2012 and whom you'll hear asking lots of great questions of our guest, James Loach. So let me talk about our guest a little bit, then we'll get the interview started. Dr. Loach, at the time of the interview in the fall of 2012, was a researcher at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California, working on the understanding the neutrino at a deep level. And he's now a professor of physics at the Shanghai Jiao Tong University in China. He's originally from the United Kingdom, and he earned his PhD in physics from Oxford University in 2008. So let's go ahead and hear from James about the neutrino and his work on this elusive particle.
Which will be good. So I guess I'll kick things off by just maybe asking you, how did you get interested in physics when you were presumably younger than you are now? And what was it that drew you into the subject in the first place, and how did you explore physics?
Okay, it's a very strange thing. So this is a very long time ago, I guess, right? So I guess I was reading like popular science books, 12, 13, 14 years old. And I read a lot of sort of stuff that kind of age. And that's where my interest came from and where it was sort of kept in some way. So I was never particularly interested in physics at high school.
Okay.
This is somehow a little bit boring compared to the things I used to read about. The things I used to read about are more similar to what I do now, I guess.
So how did you get connected with the readings that were more interesting than the material in class? I presume it didn't come from your teacher, though.
No. I mean, these things are a long time ago when you were a kid, right? I mean, there's just things available in libraries and so forth. Okay. But, I mean, I guess people going to physics, you have particular sort of mind, particular sorts of interests, you know, so when you have good libraries and good exposure to things, you just naturally drift to your sort of area, right? And I guess it's my kind of area, or
okay.
One of them. Yeah.
So it just caught your interest,
yeah.
And then you
yeah.
kept going.
And also, like I also say, not interested in physics at school. Maybe not the mathematical things you would do, but I do have excellent physics teachers. Okay, who sort of did sort of spark my interest outside of the formal work. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So outside of just doing the classwork and things like that, you got encouraged in other ways.
Yes, yeah. Or learned about other things. Yeah.
What is a neutrino?
Well, okay, yeah. So I assume I was going to get asked lots of those sorts of questions that I don't think about.
Yeah, since you're interested in neutrino physics, that's a good one to start with. Yeah, what is a neutrino?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a philosophical side to this, I guess, but in a more practical way, like a neutrino is a very similar particle to an electron, okay, except that it doesn't have electric charge. Right? And most of the particles around us sort of interacting on a daily basis are interacting via electromagnetic forces through their electric charges. Because a neutrino doesn't have this, it interacts very weakly, right? So it's like a partner to the electron in the standard model, except that it has fewer interactions than an electron, so it's thought of as a ghostly kind of particle that can flow through material and so forth. You know, and the Earth outside the other side, and very difficult to detect and to study as a result. Okay, that's the wider thing of what a neutrino is. You know, it's a point-like particle with two interactions, gravitational and weak, and set of quantum numbers. And,
that's my very basic understanding of neutrino, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's all cataloging all the quantum numbers and all of its properties and stuff like that. Yeah.
Does it have a mass?
Yes, so neutrinos do have mass, or at least two of the neutrinos are known to have a mass. So the background to this is obviously that for many, many years they were assumed to be massless particles for the reason that they turn out to be very light and they're kind of very difficult to detect. So experiments people have done in the past to place limits or to measure their mass have not been sensitive enough to measure those masses until recent years. Okay, so about 10 years ago, for experiments called neutrino oscillation experiments, it became clear neutrinos do have a mass. And this enables lots of very interesting physical phenomena, which kind of somehow spawned quite a large subfield of particle physics to study them. They're much more interesting than was originally thought.
And in fact, it spawned your area, the experiment or experiments that you're involved in, which are attempting to measure directly things like the neutrino mass.
Yeah,
right?
Sure. So my experiment, the one that I'm doing at the moment, in the past it may have been a method to try and determine, or one way in which to determine whether neutrinos have mass. But now that you know that they do, you're interested in using it to measure what those masses are, and then other more interesting things as well.
It's really cool because we were learning like the Higgs boson is hard to detect because it's so heavy,
right.
And neutrinos hard to detect because it's so light.
But it's very sort of interesting, yeah. Though, the Higgs boson, to create them and detect them, which is the process you go through, is obviously very hard to create them and hard to detect them. And neutrinos are everywhere, okay? It's one of the most, I'm not sure if it is the most numerous particle in the universe, but certainly one of. They're flowing through you in their millions all the time. So it's sort of different to Higgs bosons, kind of it's everywhere, right?
Oh, okay.
But,
The sun's invisible. Making them all the time.
Nuclear reactors.
Nuclear reactors. Even bananas, right? The radioactive potassium in a banana, does it emit? Neutrinos,
yes,
I can't remember.
I think it would do, right?
Yeah.
Potassium 40, radioactive isotope, which is concentrated in, I guess, bananas, walnuts, this kind of stuff. Also in your body. Right? Yeah.
In the modern era of physics, why is it important to study the mass of the neutrino? Why is it important to dig deeper into the neutrino? What more can we learn, or can we hope to learn by doing that?
Okay, so I guess first thing to say about this, that this is all clearly basic physics, right? So all the studying of neutrinos is to uncover facts about the universe which are somehow interesting in their own right. And certainly almost everyone in the field feels they're doing very basic fundamental research and not applied research, right? Neutrino is, one of the building block particles of the standard model, okay? But it potentially has some exotic properties, different to other standard model particles, make it sort of interesting to look at in its own right. Okay, so the standard model of particle physics is sort of like a sort of well-studied and well-constrained object which describes most of the universe, okay, all the day-to-day things. But one sort of experiment that particle physicists do is to look, in a sense, in the corners of the standard model, different places. You look at certain things in a very great deal of precision, right? Or you try to measure properties of particles which you think should be the case but have not actually been determined. Because when you look in the very corners of this, you may find things which lie beyond this picture, okay? And in fact, the standard model is kind of known to break down at some level, right? And by studying it in great detail, you can see the bits where it sort of breaks down or fragments, And neutrinos is one of these sort of areas. So neutrinos are formally massless in the standard model, right? Okay. So even the fact of neutrino mass is something which is new and extra,
So far as we know, for instance, then, the possibly newly discovered Higgs doesn't actually help us to understand where neutrino mass came from, because in the standard model, the Higgs and neutrinos don't really talk to each other directly, right?
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But of course, the Higgs particle that's been seen, may be something much more interesting, right?
Right.
And this, obviously, it's not a podcast on that, but this is the reason you look for it. It's expected to be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Known about in advance somehow. But when you actually get it and you look at it, it may not be quite what you're expecting.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's the idea of, you know, you really test a model till it breaks, and when it breaks, you learn something really interesting about the universe, like the Rutherford model of the atom and how it failed to predict the energies of light going into and coming out of the atom. So you have the Bohr model, and then that breaks down at some point, so you have a better model that comes along, and the process repeats.
Yeah, it's a strange sort of field, though. I mean, you're always looking in these little corners and these little edges, because physics is so colossally successful at explaining everything in the world, basically, okay? That, you know, you do spend your time looking in the dark corners carefully and spending many years doing this to try and find anything that is new, you know.
How are neutrinos formed?
Okay, so I guess, I guess the neutrinos are around from many different sources, mm-hmm. right? All those ones I talk about sort of flowing through you. The vast majority of these of reasonable energies would be produced from radioactive processes, okay? So I said that they feel only gravity and the weak interaction. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be created by the weak interaction in terms of everyday sense, as well as being detected by it, right? So the weak interactions that create them typically be like radioactive beta decay, for example.
Mm-hmm. So like a neutron falling apart into a proton electron and a neutrino, something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, so for example, that process, that radioactive beta decay, is where neutrinos were first discovered or hypothesized to exist in some sense. Neutron or proton turning into a proton or neutron emitting an electron and a neutrino. Mm-hmm. If you measure the energy of the electrons coming out of this interaction, you get sort of broad distribution of energies, right? The electron energy changes all the time. The reason it changes all the time is because it's sharing its energy with a neutrino you can't see. So this tells you there's something else there.
Oh, how are neutrinos detected?
Hmm. Okay. So a taste of it. So neutrinos, we can assume for now, are generally produced in these beta decay interactions, mm-hmm. okay? And the way you detect them is by the opposite of these interactions. So most physics interactions, you know, can be switched around in order, right? So, you know, you can have, instead of like an electron and a neutrino coming out, mm-hmm. you can effectively have a neutrino coming in, you know, electron coming out the other side, mm-hmm. okay, what have you. Or you have it in the sense that the neutrino comes in and changes the nucleus that it's interacting with, in the same way that the nucleus changes when the neutrino is produced. Okay. So when you're detecting a neutrino, you're looking for a reaction of this sort, right? But neutrinos, they interact only very weakly. Okay, so a neutrino of sort of everyday energies, you know, if you fire it down into the Earth, you would expect it to come out the other side. It would only be very rarely that it would actually do anything relevant between here and the other side of the Earth, okay? So to actually, the practical process of detecting neutrinos, you do two things. You want to have a lot of neutrinos, okay, one with very, very many zeros after it, right? And then you want a very large experiment, okay? So my doctoral work also on neutrinos, we were looking for neutrinos from the Sun, and the center of the Sun is a very, very big fusion nuclear reactor that produces, you know, astounding numbers of these particles, even at the Earth, a very long distance away. Okay, so we're looking at this huge, giant source. And then we have an experiment, which is a kiloton, sort of in size, you know, like, 18 meters high object, right? And then we would see handfuls of these neutrinos a day, okay? Mm-hmm. So, you know, but you... anyway, but this, of course... It's why they're interesting, because people couldn't study them in the past, mm-hmm. and, you know, can we do that? And when we do, we find interesting stuff. Okay, so because this is the two sort of basic things. And then another thing is when I say you see a certain number of neutrinos in your detector, what this means is you see, like, little flashes of light, perhaps, or these small things, okay? Not necessarily visible to the eye, but to sensitive light detectors, you know? But lots of things can cause this, all flashes of light like this, right? One particular one is natural radioactivity. You know, you have things doing beta decays all over the place, all the different radioactive decays. And you also have radiation from outer space hitting the surface of the Earth all the time. So you try and do an experiment like my doctoral work on the surface of the Earth with just building out of random construction materials. It will just be like illuminated the whole time from a physicist's point of view, just by all the junk everywhere. So these 10 tiny little specific flashes of light, you will not see them. Just a lot of stuff, okay? So these sort of experiments, you firstly build them very deep underground. So my doctoral work is 7,000 feet below sea level in northern Canada. And then you build them out of clean materials, okay? And by clean, I mean you get, say you have water as your target, you know, you take water and you must remove all the radioactive contaminants from it, okay? And removing the radioactive contaminants to such a level that they don't pollute your experimental signal is like a very, very difficult task. So on a day-to-day basis, many of us spend our time working out ways of removing all this contamination from the materials and building these labs underground. This is like a sort of practical day-to-day thing.
And not only that, but making sure that you yourself don't then contaminate the very pure material that you're handling. You have to wear suits and gloves and
hairnets
and all that stuff so that, because humans are naturally radioactive too, and that would be a disaster if you got skin cells all over your sensitive equipment.
So. Yeah, just, you know, one fingerprint somewhere in a sensitive region of the experiment and you're rebuilding your experiment, right? Because you see this fingerprint like
glowing. Lit up inside.
But yeah, so these underground laboratories are clean rooms like semiconductor factories, okay? And the one in Canada that I worked at is, you know, in a working nickel mine. So the contrast underground is quite incredible. And yeah, and put in perspective, so I, at our time of running that particular experiment, the centre of it, you know, would be the least radioactive place in our solar system, as far as we know, okay?
Okay, so you know. You're the second person I've heard that factoid from. It must be true.
Hopefully it was the same experiment.
Yes, it was, yep.
Okay.
Yep, it was, I believe I heard that the center of the SNO, or snow detector, was the lowest radioactive point in the whole solar system. I think that I've heard that at least once before. Yeah. That's great. That's great. Okay. That's very clean.
That's it.
Okay. Well, James, thank you very much for joining us today, and we wish you a safe trip back to the West Coast.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed the interview with Professor Loach. Certainly, I know that Nicole's energy was a great deal of fun during the actual interview, and she really dove in there with those really key but insightful questions about what is a neutrino and getting Professor Loach to really kind of explain the basics of the neutrino, because after all, it's the basic things that can be world-changing. The big questions that face us now regarding the neutrino have to do with things like, what exactly is its mass? If we could understand the exact value or values of the mass of the three neutrinos that we know about in nature, that could really transform our understanding of the universe and its basic building blocks. And who knows, it might even lead the way toward a more complete theory of nature than the one that we currently have available, which is called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. It's a very effective theory of nature. It describes the observations and facts about the natural world very crisply and clearly, but it's also incomplete. It doesn't explain things like dark matter or dark energy, which have been observed in the cosmos. And it's not really clear that it gives us a satisfying explanation of what we've observed about the neutrino and its characteristics and its behavior. So you should keep your eye on neutrino physics in the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. After all, it was 26 years from the postulation of the existence of the neutrino to experimental evidence that the neutrino actually existed. And that discovery transformed our world. It completed our understanding of nuclear physics, and through that understanding, we have revolutionized things like medicine. As a species, we have come to a much greater understanding of how to treat human beings at the atomic and the subatomic level, to do as much damage to things like cancer and as little damage as possible to the rest of the human body. What things could happen as a result of answering basic questions about the neutrino? What is its mass? What is the hierarchy of its masses? Which one's heavier than the other? Which neutrino is the heaviest? Which neutrino is the lightest? What is the origin of neutrino mass in the cosmos? Does it have to do with the newly discovered Higgs boson particle, or is it something else? These are basic questions, and the answers will no doubt lead us to the next world-changing revolution as a species. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, this little tour of the elusive neutrino and its subatomic world, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Going Up Alleys. This has been Going Up Alleys, a podcast by Stephen Sekula. Music was provided by Nikoko. The song is Occipital from
from the album Classococo, available for download on Jamendo.